Welcome to CJSF's Got Pride on the Air. This week, queer, gay, lesbian, bisexual, and trans, and two-spirit communities are holding pride parades, parties, and actions in the Lower Mainland. For the next 2 hours, we bring you a roundup of in-depth interviews on queer and trans arts, history, activism, politics, and sex. First, we bring you an interview produced by Sylvia and Stuart Richardson of CJSF's very own Latin Waves. They spoke with Gary Kinsman about power, gender, and sexuality in the contemporary Canadian context.
We're very privileged this morning to have Gary Kinsman. He is a professor at the University of Calgary. He's also an author, and he's written extensively. He's a Canadian sociologist, and he's one of Canada's leading academics on lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues. He's been doing this work for decades. He's written extensively on the subject, and we're very privileged to have him on our show. He's a professor of sociology at Laurentian University in Sudbury, Ontario. Thank you again for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning, Gary. Thank you. Now, we will be celebrating Pride Day on August 1st. And, you know, it would seem that we live in a society that has gender equality. Paint a picture for us. Where are we today in Canada in terms of gender equality issues?
Well, certainly there's been major advances both in relationship to gender struggles for social justice and also sexual-related struggles for social justice, but there's still an awful long way to go. I mean, major things have been won, but there's still major things that need to be battled for. I guess the way to perhaps best think about this is a distinction between formal equality, that is sort of formal equality as individuals under the law, versus the forms of substantive inequality that and injustice and hatred and violence that women still face, that trans people still face, and that certainly queer people more generally face in our society. So there's been amazing advances, from human rights protection for lesbians and gay men to various gender equality struggles to same-sex relationship recognition to same-sex marriage. All of these have been important victories that when I first got involved in the gay liberation movement in the 1970s, you know, certainly I wouldn't necessarily have anticipated that we would have won by this point in time, but we have won them, but there's still an awful long way to go. There's still lots of hatred and violence towards queer people and trans people out there on the streets. There's still pervasive discrimination against young queer people in high schools and on the streets. There's still forms of censorship that exist in relationship to our sexualities and in terms of gender identities and gender variants and trans issues. There's still an awful lot of issues that we have to tackle. So in a certain sense, we've established formal legal equality in a number of areas, not in all areas, but we haven't yet achieved substantive social equality or liberation. And I think one of the ways you can see that is, you know, if you sort of scratch the surface of liberal tolerance towards trans people or queer people, you will often see pretty vicious signs of hatred and bigotry towards us. And I think the reason for that, even with all these gains, is that we haven't got at the real roots of the problem, which is the social relations of sexism, heterosexism, the two-gender binary system that still dominates our society. These are what we really have to get to achieve more substantive social equality.
How does sexism exacerbate the inequality in society and contribute to maintain this hierarchically organized system of inequality?
Well, sexism is quite central to how oppression and domination are organized in our society. The sort of domination in general still to this day of men over women, even though there's been major strides that the feminist movement has made, is still a pervasive feature in our society, in workplaces, in waged work, in households. I mean, we have to remember that still the vast majority of domestic and reproductive labor is done by women in our society, and it's not paid for. Therefore, given we live in a capitalist society where you have to have a wage, you have to have money to have power in our society, it means that women are, you know, quite unequal to men in lots of ways. And we also know in the waged workforce that Women still continue to earn less than men. We know that there's pervasive forms of both sexual and non-sexual violence that continue to be organized against women in their everyday lives. And it also divides the working class, if you want to put it that way, by putting sort of the male section of the working class on top, so to speak, of the women's section or the female section of the working class. It causes pervasive divisions in our society. And until we actually get at the roots of sexism, we're also not able to address the roots of the oppression of queer people or trans people, because our oppression is also bound up with the oppression that women experience in our society.
One of the things I'm interested in is the way institutions contribute to inequality, both economic, social, and cultural, distinction. What role has the education system played in continuing gender inequality?
I mean, the education system plays a major part. I mean, it's certainly, quite a participating type of institutional network in these sets of relationships that organize sexism and heterosexism. One of the things about the education system is, on the sort of ideological level, it claims that everyone gets treated equally, that everyone has sort of equal rights and equal possibilities for advancement. When we look at what actually happens is that the school system, despite those claims to equality for all, actually continues through its hidden curriculum, through its official curriculum, through the very ways in which schools are organized, the ways in which men still oftentimes, especially at the higher levels in education, still have more power than women, even though there's been major changes there. What we see is there's a continuing reproduction or a continuing production of sexism and gender inequality and streaming of people into different types of job classifications and job destinations and careers that continue to perpetuate a sexist gender division of labor in which men still have more power and more privilege than women, even though women have made major advances. There's also major problems within the school system and the education system when it comes to trans people and queer people. I mean, the very form, the sort of assumed normality of heterosexuality and the heterosexual family in the school system means that schools can still be what I often describe as sort of heterosexist regimes of terror for young trans and queer people in our society. And I think we have to begin to deal with this in a more radical way, that is, getting to the root of the problem way, than we have so far. It's not just a question of making some modifications to the curriculum or having sort of more out queer people in the schools or having more women in positions of authority. It's also that we have to challenge the very sort of social form of education, which is based on sexism and heterosexism. So we really need a more profound challenge to education so it can really deal with substantive equality and developing that and end its participation in reproducing sexism and heterosexism.
One of your latest books is The Canadian War on Queers, National Security as Sexual Regulation. How has this idea of the law as legitimizing institution contributed to the exacerbation of inequality and discrimination for gays and lesbians?
It's really important to point out that oftentimes how discrimination and prejudice and domination and exclusion are organized is through institutions and through the law, especially if you're looking at the national security campaigns against lesbians and gay men, but also national security campaigns against any group of people that's been sort of expelled from the fabric of the nation, and oftentimes right now Muslim and Arab-identified people living in Canada are expelled from the fabric of the Canadian nation. What you see is that's centrally accomplished and organized through laws and institutions, and it's not simply just the individual prejudices of, let's say, security officers or the police that produce this. It's the actual laws, it's the actual national security policies that, for instance, in the Canadian War on Queers, constructed lesbians and gay men per se because we supposedly suffered from a character weakness as being risks to Canadian national security and therefore supposedly vulnerable to blackmail from evil Soviet agents. Interestingly enough, of all the people we talked to, the only people they mentioned whoever tried to blackmail them was the RCMP themselves, trying to get the names of other lesbians and gay men out of the lesbians and gay men they were interrogating. So certainly the law, the police, the national security apparatus, various institutions have played an absolutely central role in organizing discrimination and oppression. It's not just sort of bad ideas in individual people's heads, although sometimes there are bad ideas in people's heads that lead them to bigotry and prejudice. It's how those laws, those institutions, those social relations systematically organize these problems for women, for lesbians and gay men, for trans people in our everyday lives. So we need a broader type of institutional transformation, challenging those institutions and policies. Doing educational work with individuals, for instance, with the police trying to do sensitivity training around lesbian and gay or trans issues, is important, but it's not in and of itself going to get to the root of the problem. We have to change the laws. We have to change the way in which the police and the law are organized if we're really going to move towards more liberation for people.
One of the things that come to mind immediately when you're talking about the way the law has been used to not only legitimize injustice has been the use of the law against same-sex unions. Can you talk a little bit about how this impacts not only the fabric of the families involved, but also the communities at large? Why it harms us all to have these kinds of, you know, sexist and discriminating policies in place?
Well, I mean, if we look at the whole history of family law, marriage law, I mean, it's based on a very patriarchal history of the domination of men over women and their families, right? I mean, you know, for centuries and centuries, women were basically seen as the property of men. You know, it's important to remember it's only in 1983 in Canada that it became legally possible for a husband to be charged with raping his wife. Prior to that point in time, a woman's body, the wife's body, was seen as simply being the sexual property of the man, and he could have unrestricted access to it. That was only changed through years of organizing by the feminist movement, and was a very, very important and useful change. So there's a whole history of the family and marriage that's been very patriarchal in character, that's constructed only some types of families and support networks as being normal, that deserve state support. And it's been really a problem for lots of lesbians and gay men that we've been defined when we have relationships and that we raise children together as not being proper families, as not being proper relationships, as not really having spouses, as not having the sort of formal legal right to marry. And it's been absolutely crucial that we've been able to win, at least on major levels, those battles for recognition of lesbian and gay families as actually being families, recognizing that we can actually have spousal relationships that get recognized under the law, and also same-sex marriage. But it's also important to point out there's a bit of a problem here. The same-sex marriage struggle has been an important one and a vital victory, and it's especially important in places like Argentina and other countries where people have been actually mobilizing and putting a lot of energy into it. But in Canada, we actually faced a choice. We could have actually decided not to simply go for being let into what have largely been heterosexist and patriarchal institutions like marriage, for instance. We could have actually said, well, maybe we should do it differently. Maybe we should try and organize relationships that have more democracy, more mutuality, more consent, more empowerment involved in them. And I think in some ways, even though winning the legal right to marriage for same-sex couples has been absolutely crucial and vital, we missed a historic opportunity in alliance with the feminist movement and other movements of people to argue for different types of relationships between people. Because the position I put forward, which is not necessarily popular in sort of the mainstream lesbian and gay community that's fought really hard for same-sex marriage, is that, yes, we absolutely have to have the right to marry, because, of course, if that's denied to us and it's only given to heterosexuals, it's a major form of discrimination against us. But on the other hand, to privilege marriage over and against other types of relationships that people have in our society is also a social practice of discrimination. So it seems to me that feminism and lesbian gay liberation need to push further in terms of trying to establish relationships of mutuality and equality. But on the ground, for lots of people, winning the right to same-sex marriage, spousal recognition, that we can actually adopt children, has made an incredible difference in the lives of many lesbians and gay men, especially those of us who are raising kids together.
How can people break the cycle of discrimination that seems to me endemic and part and parcel of a capitalist system that's organized on exploitation?
I mean, it's important for us to realize that there's no one place that we can sort of centrally focus. We need to sort of try to challenge and refuse and break those connections at many, many different points. And in different people's experiences and lives and struggles, those breaking points, those moments of saying no I'm not going to continue to experience this oppression. You know, I've put up with this long enough. I'm not going to put up with it any further. Those moments are going to come for different people and different groups of people at different points in time. I think the most crucial thing is for us to recognize that all of those different struggles, those different rupture points, those different moments of refusal, those different moments of challenge, we need to start to link them together, to link those different struggles together, whether they're related explicitly to gender oppression and exploitation, whether they're related to lesbian and gay or sexual oppression, whether they're related to the pervasive forms of racialization and racism that exist in our society towards people of color and indigenous people, whether they're related to class questions, whether they're related to poverty, whether they're related to age, whether they're related to ability. We need to begin to figure out how we can connect all of those struggles together and see how all of those struggles, you know, impact on all of us, and how beginning to support other people's struggles can actually open up the door for us towards a socially transformed type of society in which all of the various forms of oppression and exploitation could actually be challenged, and we can actually begin to envisage what a different type of society without capitalism and without oppression might begin to look like. And I think one of the important things for me about some of the struggles that have been going on over the last 10 years or so in terms of the global justice movement, climate justice movements, the lesbian and gay movements, the feminist movement, has been that we've been trying to develop new types of relationships in the midst of those struggles. We can't develop totally new types of relationships because we're still bound up within forms of capitalist oppression and exploitation and other forms of oppression, but we can begin to prefigure or point towards the types of social relations that could exist if we could actually move beyond or rupture with capitalism and oppression. It seems to me those moments of insight that we can actually live our lives in different ways, that another world is not only possible, but it's beginning to emerge in small little glimpses here and there, that can really give us a lot of hope and optimism to continue our struggle. So it's really important for us to listen to other people, to learn from their struggles, and to also see how their struggles can be part of transforming the social worlds that we're part of as well.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Gary Kinsman. His latest book, The Canadian War on Queers, National Security as Sexual Regulation. How can people access your book?
I'm sure in Vancouver, Little Sisters is one of the places that they can get the book. And I should just point out the book's also co-authored with Patricia Gentile. But Little Sisters, I'm sure it's now getting into other major bookstores in Vancouver as well. It's published by the University of British Columbia Press. So if people have any problems accessing it, they can always contact UBC Press directly. And if you actually just Google UBC Press or the Canadian War on Queers, you'll get lots of information about how to access it.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Take care.
You're listening to Pride on the Air, a special program of CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting here in Burnaby. Now we go to Abbotsford. We often associate Pride events, queer activism, and even simply queer communities with urban metropolitan settings. But we exist everywhere, whether or not our communities recognize us. The small city of Abbotsford is often referred to as BC's Bible Belt, and they had their first Pride event in 2008. John Kuipers is the program coordinator for the Fraser Valley Youth Society in Abbotsford, and he organizes their queer youth drop-in. He joins me by phone. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
So what kind of problems do queer youth face in Abbotsford that might be different from youth here in Vancouver?
Well, I think that the biggest difference between youth in Abbotsford or queer youth in Abbotsford and youth in more densely populated areas is the fact that there's not really a lot out here for them. I think that services for queer youth are just... pretty much lacking in some sense. I mean, I run a drop-in for gay and lesbian youth, but that is currently the only service that's available for any queer population. So I think that just that sort of lack of service or minimal level of service is the biggest thing. I think also that there is discrimination that happens from less open-minded people, specifically in this community. But yeah. So those are probably the main things.
What is it like in the schools?
The school settings, they are, well, they can be challenging for some queer youth who like to express themselves a little bit more openly. I think that discrimination, you know, it happens everywhere, but I think that in this community, at least in my experiences, to the people that I've met, that they do face more discrimination, and that comes from various levels, not only from students, but also from staff and administrative people in the school setting. So it can be a challenge for sure.
And what kind of services does your organization provide for these youth?
Well, essentially we just run a drop-in for gay and lesbian youth. It runs every week on Thursday nights. And what we also do is we take our kids down to Vancouver for Pride events that GAB Youth Services puts on, like dances, and we take them to the parade and have entry in the parade each year, and then take them to the Pride dance after for the youth. So they've always enjoyed that, and that's pretty much what we do. That's all we can sort of afford to do. We all work on a volunteer basis, so yeah.
Right. And why did the queer communities there decide to organize that first Pride event back in 2008?
Well, the Pride event started actually with a group of youth wanting to have a Pride parade in Abbotsford. And I said, oh, sure, why not, right? So I started to get the ball rolling, figure out what it would take as far as regulations and permits from the city. And I was running into several barriers from city officials, and at the same time as these kids were wanting to do something to express their pride, they were also dealing with an issue in the schools with Social Justice 12, which is a class that several of our kids had signed up for. However, the school district had decided to remove the course due to the queer content in there, so I had discussions with the kids to say that seeing as we were having difficulty kind of holding a parade in Abbotsford, that it may be a better idea to hold a rally for social justice and sort of advocate against the school district to be able to get this course back on the roster so the kids could take it. So we decided that we would do that instead, and collaborated with folks at the University of the Fraser Valley and with the Abbotsford Police Department and other sort of like-minded individuals who are willing to help us with our cause. And we ended up having a march here through the streets of Abbotsford and gathered at the University of the Fraser Valley to have several speakers talk about social justice and the need for queer content within the education system. So it was was a success. The course is now offered in Abbotsford, and yeah, we hope to be able to do something of the like again in the future.
Why was that Social Justice 12 course dropped?
Well, I think that the school district didn't give a definite answer. However, I think that their response was something along the lines of the fact that parents had expressed sort of discomfort with some of the content, or the content that maybe not everybody agrees with, which was many of us agree that I would specifically be referring to the queer content that was in the curriculum, and it was labeled a gay class pushing a gay agenda, which really it's not. I mean, it's essentially about social justice and many other issues, but because of that queer content, the class was pulled, and they had come up with a global studies class that essentially had the same curriculum but did not have any queer content in it. So it would lead one to believe that the reason that the social justice class was removed and reinstated with a global studies class without queer content. So I think that the main reason would have been because of the information on gay and lesbian issues.
And you said now that course is back in the school.
Yeah, and now the social justice class is being offered in the Abbotsford School District with all of the content that it originally was meant to have. So it's good.
And what other kind of reaction did that rally receive from the larger community in Abbotsford?
I think that, in my experience, I had a lot of people support, but then I had also had a lot of remarks from people that did not support the cause. I think that the media had done a good job of facilitating an open discussion in the papers. I had been interviewed by the paper and given my perspective and had informed them of what we were doing, and there was a lot of positive and also a lot of negative responses in letters coming into the paper of just this sort of, you know, really anti-gay rhetoric that was coming from certain individuals within the community. If somebody was willing to write into the paper and express their extreme distaste with what was happening or what was planning to happen within the community, then, I think that sort of does speak to some of the individuals that are in this town and their views on homosexuality.
Has there been a Pride event since?
We have not held an event of the same sort of nature as the social justice rally that we held back in 2008. However, we have for the past 3 years, the Fraser Valley Youth Society has hosted an annual Walk Away from Homophobia in May. So we did that again this year with success, and of course we always get people who, you know, take up the cause with us, and we hear from others who don't, but I think that holding that Walk Away from Homophobia each year is sort of a small thing that we can continue to do without too much backlash from the city or too much issues from people who don't really like what we're doing. But it is our hope that we can expand that in years to encompass something a little bit more like what we had back in 2008, with support from surrounding communities and really just a solid march of solidarity through the streets with pride flags, just letting people know that there are gay people in Abbotsford in rural communities, and we're not going to sort of put up with the systemic sort of issues that sort of oppress and marginalize people of that sexual minority.
Yeah, that would be really great. The Walk Away from Homophobia picket line sound really powerful too.
Yeah. It's a fun event. I think that it's great to see people in the community come out and support us, so it's good.
What barriers stand in the way from holding that kind of pride event with larger community solidarity coming out?
I think that really getting a group of solid, organized people together and being able to advocate to city officials and jump through all of the hoops that are put in place here to be able to hold something like that in the city. So it takes money, it takes a lot of work, it just takes those people to be able to fight hard for the ability to do that again. And I guess the issue was so charged previously that we did have a lot of support, seeing as we were sort of advocating on behalf of, you know, citizens who wanted to see this class social justice 12 be reinstated. So this time around, I think that we need to just organize ourselves again and say we would like to do, you know, a pride parade. But I think it takes that organization, it takes money, and it takes the people. So it can be done.
Will we see one in the years coming?
I hope so.
I hope so, too. What would be the most immediate things you'd like to see changed in Abbotsford?
I think the most immediate thing that I would like to see is the increase in service provision for gay and lesbian people out here. Like I said before, the Fraser Valley Youth Society does run the only service for queer people out here in the Valley, and that is specifically for youth. I think that something of a hub, a building or a center for gay and lesbian individuals to come, you know, a drop-in for youth or young adults or even seniors, to be able to come together, socialize with other queer people, have sexual health resources and just sort of a place where people can come and they know that it's a safe and open environment would be great to have out here in the Valley. But again, you know, that takes money and that takes time, but it is possible. So I think that that's something that we could use out here.
Well, I hope it comes.
I hope so, too.
I hope it comes soon.
Thank you, yeah.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you, and I hope you enjoy Pride. I'm assuming you're coming this year for the Pride Parade in Vancouver.
We're taking a bus full of youth and volunteers out to Vancouver this year, so we'll be out there.
Great. Well, enjoy, and thanks for joining us on the air.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I've been speaking with John Kuipers. He is the program coordinator for the Fraser Valley Youth Society, and he organizes their queer youth drop-in in Abbotsford, B.C. If you would like more information on the Fraser Valley Youth Society, you can visit their website at fraseryouth.com. You're listening to Pride on the Air, a special program of CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. Now we go to the Vancouver Trans Forum with CJSF's Maria Pashdotter.
This last weekend, July 23rd to 25th, was the Vancouver Trans Forum, a gathering for transgender people, their friends, and allies. Transgender, for those of you who are not familiar with the terminology, is an umbrella term for all those whose gender identity doesn't match their assigned sex, or whose gender role simply doesn't conform unambiguously to conventional notions of gender. While there's been people organizing around transgender issues for years here in Vancouver, this forum was the first of its kind. It featured a multitude of different seminars, workshops, and activities. For example, there were several sessions on transgender rights within the healthcare system, a planning group meeting on how to address police harassment, workshops on self-defense, as well as a session on trans experiences in post-secondary education. There were also film screenings, performances, and an all-body swim. The forum concluded with a Trans Pride March. I was at the forum and I had the honor to speak to James Diamond. James is a writer, director, producer, and mentor in communications and multimedia. James's film, Mars Womb Men, was screened at the Trans Film Festival that happened in conjunction with the forum. I first asked James about the role of the Trans Forum.
Well, everyone has their individual needs that they want to fulfill, like coming here. So, you know, it's finding that balance of a structured system that can facilitate freedom. Maybe eventually it can be the other way around. I don't know.
What do you mean by that?
Well, just that there's just so much freedom out there that, you know, the structure is kind of like a side effect. I just feel like people are more concerned with the structure than the chaos. Fighting the chaos with structure. But not necessarily seeing the freedom within chaos or whatever. I don't know. I'm just newly on this anarchy thing. Like I don't know what it means to anyone, but that's what I like about it, is that it's like, you know, a label that's counteracting the system of having labels.
Mm-hmm.
So can be ironic and hypocritical very easily, but if I'm going to join something, it's people that don't want to join anything, really. But I've had times where it was very important to be around other people that were somewhere in the transgender spectrum. But now, when I've been doing so much work, I've been out as a transgender person, although I've never really called myself that, you know, since I was 18, and I'm 33 now. So, you know, I'm coming here and trying not to be some jaded old person who doesn't need support anymore or anything like that. I'm trying to listen to what the process has been like, but I feel like with any groups, it has to start with the indigenous people of the land. And, you know, it's not even an appropriate term because it's English, but it's two-spirited. And this is a huge lesson that we need to learn, as well as, you know, intersex, the physical manifestation of, you know, somebody's possibly ambiguously gendered. You know, these are just very undeniable terms that could help, you know, help all people. And not saying that transgender is not that, but just being aware that the work that you're doing is on occupied territories and that there is a pre-existing system that we should be conscious of.
Do you feel like the Transforum, I guess, has done a good job of including diverse perspectives on gender and engaging the Indigenous community? And like, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, they can only do so much. I mean, I'm not expecting them to like reverse colonialism or anything. But yeah, it's hard when you have a minority voices, you expect so much out of them sometimes, and it's not really fair, but you also want to understand, like, say, maybe gay and lesbian need to learn about queer, maybe queer needs to learn about transgender, maybe transgender needs to learn about two-spirit, like, just always looking at where you came from and where you're going. You know, there's been Indigenous people who are been present giving workshops about whatever they're acknowledged in. It doesn't have to be about Indigenous issues, obviously, but I think, yeah, they've done as good as they can. I mean, it's Vancouver. I went to the People of Color group, and I was one of three people in there, and we had a packed group that I could hear, you know, on the other side of the wall. You know, it doesn't really matter what else their issue was, but I also wanted to be at that workshop, right? But, you know, I didn't want to leave only two people to be in this. So, you know, I'm in a weird situation there where I don't know whether my identity is just for the sake of identity or it's really who I am.
That was an interview with writer, director, and producer James Diamond, done at the Vancouver Trans Forum this last weekend. To find out more about the Vancouver Trans Forum, go online to vancouvertransforum.com.
You're listening to Pride on the Air, a special program of CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. Now we go to the borders and Parliament Hill to look at refugee policy. Thousands of people arrive in Canada seeking asylum from economic, physical, and political violence. Many are accepted with refugee status, while many others are turned away. The Conservative government of Canada recently introduced a piece of legislation to reform the country's refugee system. To discuss how government policy affects the lives of queer and trans refugees, I'm joined on the phone by Sherilyn Jordan. Sherilyn is completing her doctoral research on queer refugee settlement and is a member of the Rainbow Refugee Committee. Hello, Sherilyn.
Good morning.
So before we talk about the system here in Canada, the refugee system, what kinds of problems are queer and trans refugees fleeing?
To give you a sense of kind of the picture internationally, there are 80 countries that criminally sanction lesbian, gay, bi, or trans people. And then there are others that also use things like morality laws or laws against public assembly to criminally sanction queer and trans people. There are 5 that maintain the death penalty. I can give you some examples of situations that Rainbow Refugee members have left. So we have quite a few folks from Sri Lanka, and the situation they faced there was when they met at a beach that was kind of known as a place for queer people to hang out, as they were leaving, they would be picked up by police. Sri Lanka maintains a 12-year prison sentence for homosexuality, although it's rarely used. But this, the existence of these sanctions would be used by the police to then threaten and extort money from people. Many were beaten or sexually assaulted while they were in custody by police. And then the police would return sort of once a month asking for more money and threatening to out them if they didn't pay up. So that kind of gives a sense of the kinds of things people are having to deal with, queer and trans people are having to deal with. So people have to live with a great deal of constraint and in hiding in order to survive.
So there's definitely state-sanctioned violence happening all around the world.
Yes, yes. There's state-sanctioned violence happening in at least, as I said, 80 countries. There are also situations where it may not be state-sanctioned, but countries don't have anti-discrimination laws or measures to protect queer and trans people, and then there's sort of pervasive social intolerance and violence, and so people facing those kinds of situations would also be able to make a claim for refugee protection.
Right. So before this recent reform, what did it take for queer and trans folks to be accepted under refugee status?
Yeah. One of the most challenging things is people cannot make a refugee claim in their own country. They have to get out of their own country and make this claim at either a UNHCR office or in Canada itself. And often the hardest thing for people is getting out, particularly for women and also for trans folks. Crossing borders is really challenging. Getting a visa to come into Canada is very hard if you don't have property, if you don't have significant ties to your country. So that's, I think, one of the most challenging things people deal with. And then once they've actually made their claim, the situation here in Canada, I think I'll focus on that.
Mm-hmm.
People arrive, and sort of the first thing that they deal with is needing to look a government official in the eye and say, I need to make a refugee claim. And then the question they'll deal with is, on what grounds? For folks who have had to be very, you know, very careful and cautious about who they disclose their sexuality or gender to, this is a really frightening moment. So that's sort of the second challenge people deal with. I know one fellow who spent 27 days in detention here in Canada before kind of working up the nerve to tell his duty counsel.
Wow.
That he was gay, and that was why he needed to make a refugee claim.
So these would be like customs and border agents, or once they've reached a city, or
typically at an airport.
Okay.
There'll be the officers of the Canada Border Services will be the first people that they speak to, unless they come into Canada sort of as a student or on a temporary work permit, that kind of thing, and then they would make an inland claim at an office of citizenship and immigration, and then they're working with an immigration official. Either way, it's a government officer, and for folks coming from countries where police and officials are exactly the people they've needed to be careful of, this is a really terrifying moment.
Right, and what do they need to be able to provide those government officials to be accepted?
Under the current system, that first interview, just make sure that they're eligible to make a refugee claim. And so this is fairly, you know, they don't need to provide a lot of documentation at this point. They then go and work with a lawyer who helps them put together all of their evidence. And this includes things like needing to document their sexual orientation or their gender identity. So that can involve sort of getting letters from past lovers, sometimes letters, hospital records or medical records, that kind of thing for trans folks. And then also documenting their fear of persecution in their home country. So that can be, again, sort of if they've had dealings with the police, whatever, trying to retrieve whatever records there are of that. And that, as you can imagine, is quite tough. those are all compiled and given to the refugee board 20 days before their hearing. So, sorry, after 1 month, they provide a narrative that explains the basis of their case, and then 20 days before their hearing, they put in all their documentation.
And then what happens after their hearing?
So their hearing, I might want to talk a little bit about what that looks like. There's a member of the refugee board listening to their and asking questions about their case. Sometimes there's a representative of the government there as well, sort of asking questions from a perspective of protecting the integrity of the refugee system. And they're working through an interpreter. So there's usually about three people in the room, as well as the lawyer and the claimant. And the challenges there are around, in this really kind of tense, kind of quasi-judicial space, having to talk about really, quite intimate, sometimes very painful memories, sometimes memories that are connected with physical trauma or sexual trauma, with a person who holds kind of absolute life or death decision-making power.
No kidding.
So that's the hearing. And then sometimes people find out right away at the hearing that they've been granted refugee protection. Sometimes there's a wait. We know people who've had to wait, a couple of weeks. I know one person who's waited over a year to hear. Now, that doesn't happen often, but it can happen.
And then if it does take up to a year, what do people do? How do they get by?
Once a person is found eligible to make a refugee claim, and that happens fairly early, they can submit an application for a work permit.
Okay.
Okay. And it takes usually a couple of months, and then they apply for work. We know folks who are kind of scraping by, piecing together 2 and 3 part-time jobs while they wait. They're also eligible for social assistance, and that kicks in, again, as soon as people are found eligible to make a refugee claim. And so many people do require social assistance for sort of the first few months while they're waiting for their work permit.
Mm-hmm. So it's by no means an easy process.
No.
Or it was by no means an easy process.
No.
Before this reform.
People are living in a great deal of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And dealing with kind of all the struggles of getting by in a new culture, a new city, trying to rebuild a home, a life, friends, while their lives are in limbo.
And then now with this conservative government reform legislation, Bill C-11, how will this bill change the process for these queer and trans refugees?
Yeah, there are a couple of things that are really important about the new reform package. And I'll be honest, we're not fully sure what it's going to look like when it's actually implemented. The devil's often in the details. But one of the things we're concerned about is there's a provision now it's called the designated country list. So what this does is it gives the minister's office power to say people from certain nations will now be processed in an expedited way, in a faster way. Okay? We are happy that provision was changed pretty substantially from the original version. The original version would have denied right of appeal to people from countries on the list, and that would have been fundamentally unjust. The expedited processing is an improvement over that, but still something we're concerned about. The other major concern we have about the new reforms is that people no longer will be making their first, sort of telling their story for their first time with a lawyer. Instead, they've added an interview at 15 days with a government official. So it's actually, in a way, adding a step to the process, which is interesting because they say that it's about efficiency, and I'm not sure how adding a step makes something more efficient, but that we'll see. So they have an interview with a government official now at 15 days. Our concerns around that is that quite often people don't have time to connect with a lawyer within 15 days. With the way legal aid works here and just making an appointment and things like that, it's often people don't have a lawyer within their first 15 days. And going into an interview where they're going to be collecting evidence without a lawyer is really frightening for all refugees. It's particularly worrisome for queer and trans refugees because often the ways that queer and trans people experience persecution are kind of hidden from view, and people who've grown up believing that their sexuality or gender is sinful or a mental illness may not think in terms of their think of their lives in terms of human rights and be able to give us an explanation of what's happened to them in human rights terms.
It's a very particular discourse they need to use.
Exactly. So just, maybe an everyday example to ground this a bit. Often the things that are most disturbing to people are the ways that their own families have hurt them. But that is not in itself persecution. It only becomes persecution if it becomes threatening and there is no mechanism in the state to protect them. But if people don't know that, what they may emphasize when the officer says, what was your problem in your home country, may be all the things that went on in their family. They may not think to say, and I was afraid to go to the police or the police wouldn't do anything or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have seen already is that whatever people say when they first arrive, comes back at the hearings. Those notes are recorded and looked at during hearings. And one of the things that they use as sort of evidence of credibility of a person is, does your story say the same? Does it say consistent from one time to the next? And they don't look at sort of what are the conditions that people are telling these stories, explaining themselves under, but does it stay the same? And so if somebody's faced with a government official 15 days after arrival, they may be too frightened, too traumatized, just not having the trust.
Mm-hmm.
Speak openly about something like, sexual violence or even their first sexual experience with an officer.
Right.
And then if those things aren't in that initial interview or the details are, a little bit vague, it could undermine their credibility in their hearing.
Wow.
Yeah. That first interview, Peter Schaller is a refugee, let's say, scholar who has worked in the IRB and now writes extensively. And his principles for good, fair, effective refugee decision-making is the first decision should be the best decision.
Right.
And anything that gets in the way of that, it undermines fairness and undermines efficiency. So to my mind, this 15-day interview with a government officer is counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. And so just to clarify this, this designated country of origin,
mm-hmm.
The minister's office... Like, does this mean that the minister's office has the power to choose which countries are on that list and which aren't?
That's correct. And the process for how that gets decided will get written into the rules and regulations. And so we haven't seen what that will look like yet, and that's one of our concerns. What we are going to ask for is that there be somebody with expertise on LGBT, queer and trans human rights issues,
mm-hmm.
Involved in that process, and who would have the power to ask that a country be removed from the list if situations change. Because this is, making distinctions between safe and unsafe, which is kind of implicitly what they're doing with this list. Although, we managed to get rid of the language of safe in the bill, fortunately. Is really tough when it comes to persecution against queer and trans people. Situations are in flux. It may be very different from one part of a country to another, the capital city versus different regions, that kind of thing. And also people's own kind of, their social class, their faith, their gender can impact how persecution affects them. So it's really hard to make cut and dry kind of, yes, this country should be on the list, no, this country shouldn't be on a list when it comes to queer and persecution against queers and trans folks.
And how did the Canadian government justify this reform?
Well, Minister Kenney has talked about sort of sudden surges from countries where, to his mind, it's very clear people are making unfounded refugee claims. And the examples that come up are Czech and Mexico. And so what the way they handled that initially was just slapping a visa requirement on folks traveling from either Czech or Mexico. That doesn't work real well if you're wanting to have trade with these countries. And as a member of NAFTA, Canada's invested in having good trade relations with Mexico.
Right.
So they had to get rid of the visa requirement. So this is, in some ways, a preferred way of dealing with these surges, because it at least allows people to come into Canada and make a claim and have access to refugee protection. And we do still see situations where people from Mexico have a very legitimate need for refugee protection. The situation there is quite violent, and because of drug issues in certain regions, and so the police are overwhelmed. So we do see situations where people cannot access state protection despite kind of quite good constitutional protection on paper in some parts of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And including the recognition of same-sex relationships in Mexico City, but that doesn't always translate into people being able to be safe.
Yeah.
And so people, quite legitimately leave their country because they don't feel safe. They know they're in danger. And that distinction between whether it's persecution or not is a complex one.
Mm-hmm.
So the designated country list gives the state one way to kind of move people through the refugee decision process more quickly.
And what would a reform look like, what would a reform look like that actually put the needs of these impacted refugees at the center of its policy?
I think one of the first things to look at is how people actually access refugee protection. Most Western countries have put up, fairly stringent migration controls to prevent people even reaching Canada if they're from what's considered a refugee-producing country. And so we need to be looking at sort of the accessibility of refugee protection at UNHCR offices overseas, and can people make it safely to a place where they can make a refugee claim. That would be one of the first things that I would look at. And then the second would be to look at, what are the conditions people are being asked to give their account, to explain what has happened to them. So rather than putting them face-to-face with a government official where they're dealing with disbelief, I would put them, with somebody who they know is representing them first.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to be looking at the quality of evidence that refugee decision makers have access to. This is a real issue for homophobic and transphobic persecution in particular. It's taken a while for mainstream human rights organizations to start doing the kind of research that's needed around queer and trans persecution.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that we need to improve on. And then really working to maintain the independence of decision makers. And that's something that's potentially undermined in this new reform package as well that I didn't talk about. But
independence from whom?
Independence from government. We need to make sure that the refugee process does not get politicized. So right now, the refugee board, all of the people making decisions are they're part of an independent body. They are appointed by government council, so they're not civil servants. It gives them, you know, at least in principle, some independence from the policies and values and priorities of Canadian citizenship and immigration.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your analysis with us today and your overview of the system.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for your interest. I'm really glad to see that we're getting that more attention is being drawn to issues around refugee protection, and particularly refugee protection for queer and trans people.
What would you recommend for people to do if they would like to help push the government in that direction of a better system?
Yeah, thank you. Important question.
Yeah.
Well, how to get engaged, absolutely. Really good resource is for people to go to the Canadian Council for Refugee website, and there's up-to-date information there on the refugee reform package and issues there. And if people are wanting to get specifically involved around queer and trans refugees, please contact us at Rainbow Refugee, and I'll give you our email. It's info@rainbowrefugee.ca, and we also have a blog that we'll direct people to.
Great. Well, yeah, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you so much, Peter. Take care.
I have been speaking with Sherilyn Jordan. She's a member of the Rainbow Refugee Committee, and if you'd like more information on their work, you can email them, as she said, at info@rainbowrefugee.ca. And what was your blog again, the website?
It's rainbowrefugeecanada@wordpress.com.
Great.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. You're listening to Pride on the Air, a special program of CGSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting here in Burnaby.